Between the Sandy Hook massacre just under a decade ago and this week's shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, not much has changed when it comes to gun laws. After an 18-year-old killed 19 children and two teachers with an AR-15-style weapon, some members of the U.S. Senate say they are working to negotiate something that they can agree on. This comes as the NRA meets in Texas now and through the weekend amid protests at the meeting site. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you believe is the answer to preventing mass shootings? Do you think we need more or fewer guns to combat gun violence? Are you a teacher or a parent with kids in school? What are you thinking about right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, despite some high-profile mass shootings over the last bunch of years and an uptick in less high-profile shootings in cities around the country, it doesn't seem like anywhere there's been a lot in the way of changes of gun laws. What have you seen going on over the last decade?
Well, look, at the federal level, there hasn't been any major gun control laws passed since the 1990s. You'd have to go back a quarter century. And in the interim, you've got everything from Columbine to this week's shooting that has happened. So the federal government has been gridlocked on meaningful gun regulation. But most gun regulation, historically and over the past decade or two, is at the state and local level. And we have seen some changes in state and local gun laws. In fact, some states, in the wake of mass shootings, tend to loosen their gun regulations to allow more people to carry guns and to obtain different types of more lethal weapons. Other states, typically Democratic-led states, have tried to respond to the mass shootings by tightening gun restrictions. So after Sandy Hook, for instance, New York State passed the SAFE Act, Connecticut acted, other states acted as well, to limit the ability of people to get so-called assault rifles and large capacity magazines and to require universal background checks and the like. But that has not been the universal approach. So we have a patchwork of state laws now and a patchwork of approaches following these mass shootings.
And those state and local laws are constrained by what the U.S. Supreme Court says is or isn't constitutional. In fairly recent American history, the Supreme Court established that gun ownership is an individual right. This was a pretty big change, right, compared to how courts had ruled for the first couple hundred years.
Yeah, and you're referring to the case in 2008 called District of Columbia v. Heller. And so in that case, the plaintiff, Dick Heller, wanted to have a handgun in his home, unrelated to a militia service. He wanted to have it for self-defense. And Washington, D.C. had a ban on the possession of handguns in the home. And in the Supreme Court in that case, for the first time in over 200 years, said that the Second Amendment, which provides a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, protects not a militia-related right, but a private right related to individual private self-defense from criminals and the like. That case was the first time a federal appellate court had ever in the history of the United States struck down a gun law on Second Amendment grounds. So it was a landmark case, and it's opened the door to a heck of a lot of litigation. In fact, there's one Supreme Court case that is pending right now that could further inhibit the ability of governments to regulate firearms.
I wanted to ask you about that case next, coming out of, I think, New York State.
Right. So this case, it's called Bruin, it's the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin, involves a restriction on carrying handguns in public. Heller, that 2008 case, held that you have a right to have a handgun in your home for self-defense if you're not otherwise disqualified. But the case didn't deal with the ability of carrying handguns in public, where, of course, guns can present externalities and problems for other people. This case addresses that issue. In New York State and other states, in order to get a permit to carry a concealed handgun, you have to show good cause or proper cause. And what that means in eight states that have these policies is that you have to show a heightened need for self-defense. something that separates you from the general public. Saying that you just have a generalizable fear that a stranger might attack you is not enough to get a concealed carry permit in New York. So the plaintiffs in that case didn't have any special security needs that separated them from the general public. And as a result, they did not get an unrestricted permit. Rather, they got permits to carry handguns to and from work and in certain other unpopulated places. And they're saying that that policy violates their Second Amendment rights. And after oral arguments, it seemed like the conservative majority on the Supreme Court right now agrees. And if they were to strike that down, this would be a significant divergence from the consensus view in the lower federal courts, which have by and large upheld these policies. New York's policy, for example, goes back over a century.
What, of course, it depends on how the Supreme Court rules, even if they do overturn this law. What are other laws then that might be challenged under a ruling overturning that law in New York?
Right. And Rob, I think that you hit the nail on the head. A lot depends on how the Supreme Court issues its ruling. So assuming that the majority of the justices are going to strike down New York's law, that will have, or at least this proper cause component of New York's law, that will have immediate next day effects for a quarter of Americans who live in places where you have to show this height and self-defense need in order to get carry a handgun in public. Those places can expect more people carrying handguns in public. And that alone has been associated in the research with an uptick in aggregate violent crime. So that is one thing that people can expect in those places. The data suggests that the increase in other places that have loosened their public carry restrictions can be in the range of 10 to 15% uptick in certain violent crimes. So those places will try to compensate with new laws. But it's also possible the Supreme Court says, look, it's unconstitutional to even require a license to carry a handgun in public. In other words, the permitless carry movement that we're seeing across the country right now is correct about the fact that that is the constitutional standard. Now, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court goes that far, but if they did, that would affect a lot more states' laws. And there's another thing that's at issue in this case that I think is merits attention, which is that the plaintiffs and others in the case are asking the Supreme Court to declare the overall methodology that the lower courts are applying in these cases to be the improper methodology. And instead, they want the Supreme Court to say that in Second Amendment challenges, the constitutionality of a law depends solely on history and tradition, such as the history of gun regulation at the time that the Second Amendment was enacted in 1791, or maybe when the 14th Amendment was enacted in 1868. And it does not care about modern gun violence and modern solutions to modern gun violence. And if that is something that the Supreme Court does, if it says that that is the metric for determining the constitutionality of gun laws, the impact will be much broader than just public carry. In fact, it would affect all weapons laws that have been challenged in the years since Heller. Courts have overwhelmingly upheld gun regulation, largely by virtue of the fact that they determine that gun regulations that are being challenged sufficiently further an important public interest in stopping gun violence today, modern gun violence. If the court makes this methodological change, however, it would reopen litigation across issues. So we'll see new challenges to so-called assault weapon bans, large capacity magazine restrictions on who can have a gun, such as whether or not felon in possession laws are unconstitutional, or laws seeking to keep firearms away from the mentally ill. The whole range of firearms laws and knife laws and all other weapons laws would be reopened to constitutional challenge.
We're talking to Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University, who studies Second Amendment rights, looking at the status of gun laws in the United States, how they may or may not change in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes in gun regulations in one direction or another? Are you a parent worried about sending your kid to school after this week and previous school shootings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Eric Rubin from Southern Methodist University, looking at gun laws and gun reform in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, would you like to see changed? 800-642-1234. Jeremy joins us now in Superior. Jeremy, hello.
Hi, thank you. Every time something like a horrible tragedy like this happens, and it has to involve a firearm, the same thing keeps, same narrative keeps being brought up. Blaming the object, blaming the tool, blaming the gun. It is absolutely ludicrous that this keeps happening, how we're blaming an object for the actions of an individual. And I'm going to use an analogy that I've used quite a bit. If a contractor comes to your home, installs a brand new door, and the door is crooked, do you blame the contractor's hammer, or do you blame the contractor himself?
Well, Jeremy, let me ask you, Jeremy, fully automatic weapons in the country are illegal, almost completely illegal, because people see them as a tool that allows too much lethality. Is there a limit for you for how lethal a tool could be between automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons, where we say maybe that tool lets that bad person do too much damage?
Well, for one, and like you said, fully automatic weapons are illegal in the United States. Semi-automatic weapon is a very, very common weapon and tool used for hunting, sport shooting. I own multiple myself. Never has one of my guns gone off on its own or shot at in anybody's direction. And if anything happens, the trigger needs to be pulled by an individual. And I'm sorry, mental health is the number one issue in the entire debate. It's not guns.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Mental health, often not involved in these shootings, Eric. But to his point, do we blame the tool or the person?
Look, I mean, obviously there's not just one thing here, but it's hard to discount the increased lethality of firearms. One of the ironies about the argument that Jeremy was raising is that a lot of gun rights advocates would balk at the suggestion that they should just defend themselves with a knife or with a taser or without any weapon whatsoever. They insist that the firearm itself enables them to better protect themselves. And the same thing happens on the flip side. Firearms are more lethal than other types of weapons. They intensify violence. And the data backs this up. So, one of the quips you might think about is there's no such thing as a drive-by knifing, right? You can use a gun to shoot somebody at distance. If a gun is used in an assault, it is likely to be more lethal than if a different weapon is used. So yeah, of course, firearms don't shoot themselves. They require the efforts of the shooter as well. But if you have somebody with mental health issues, as Jeremy said, or somebody who is intent on violence, they're going to most likely be more lethal if they can get their hands on a gun, and a gun that can dispel more bullets faster than if they can't. And so I think that's one of the logics between some of the incremental changes that are suggested in terms of gun regulation. Are they going to solve gun violence? No. But would they incrementally perhaps make improvements? I think that is where the debate really is.
Jeremy, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jim now in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think it's important that people maintain the ability to defend themselves. There's not often spoken of, but there's a couple million times a year, it's pretty well documented, that violent crimes are prohibited by private ownership of firearms. And the canard about large capacity magazines is also apparent in cases like the elderly gentleman who heard people breaking into his home and defended himself with a 30-round magazine against four armed individuals, each with 15-round magazines in their pistols.
Jim, thanks for the call. Defensive gun use often cited, Eric, as an argument against gun law changes.
Yeah, so this is obviously one of the big public policy issues that is going on right now, is that firearms are used defensively. Of course, there are anecdotes of that. Now, I think that a lot of times the number of times and the proportion of self-defense incidents that involve a firearm is exaggerated. The National Crime Victimization Survey, which is the best data that we have on this, suggests that less than 1% of self-defense incidents involve the defensive use of a firearm. As many defensive incidents, according to that survey, involve weapons other than firearms, so think knives and the like. And then well over 90% of self-defense incidents don't involve a weapon at all. But it is true that firearms can be used defensively, just like they can be used offensively. To Jim's point about the fact that if you are attacked by, you know, multiple people who are carrying automatic weapons, would you want to have the firepower to defend against those people? Sure, there's some intuitive value to that, but I think that those types of attacks are less likely. And the question in terms of policy is that you're not going to have a perfect solution to providing people with self-defense in every single situation. You're not going to have the perfect solution to preventing gun violence. You have to weigh the pros and the cons of these different policy solutions. And that ultimately leaves a lot of people dissatisfied.
Thanks for the call. Randy joins us now in Ripon. Randy, hello.
Hi. I just want to point out, I served in the military. I qualified as a marksman. And it's one thing to shoot at a target when you're calm, cool, and relaxed. And I've had friends and acquaintances that carry guns, pistols. And one thing I point out to them, I say, are you fully prepared to pull that gun out and mistakenly kill an innocent person or be mistaken for the bad guy by the authorities? Because the bad guy isn't wearing a sign saying, hey, I'm the bad guy, shoot me. And there could be another fellow doing the same thing you're doing. This is all really naive. Thinking you can just whip out a gun and start blasting away and be a hero, because it's real easy to miss when your adrenaline's pumping. That's all I got to say.
Randy, thanks for sharing your experience there. Eric, what do you think?
No, of course. I mean, some of the data involving police shootings is somewhat stark in that police miss their targets a lot and they have to train repeatedly. And I think that this also brings up another policy that's at issue right now, and it's being debated in Wisconsin and other places, is whether or not we should remove the permitting requirement before you can carry a concealed weapon altogether. And one of the, and this is, you know, called by some advocates for it constitutional carry, it's permitless carry. And one of the things that you give up if you make that change is to get the permit. Most places require you to go through some sort of gun training, some live shooting. And if you remove that, you also remove the requirement that people actually train with their guns. And to Randy's point, even if people are trained, you still miss a lot. And it's a consideration, I think, that should be on the table as we're debating permitless carry.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Eric Rubin, law professor at Southern Methodist University, looking at the politics and law of gun control in the United States. Eric, I don't want to let the time get passed without visiting the U.S. Senate. We talked some about the courts. There is talk of at least some kind of negotiation among Democrats and Republicans to do something TBD right now. What kind of things are you watching for in the U.S. Senate?
You know, I mentioned this before, there hasn't been any significant gun safety regulation at the federal level for a quarter century. Anything that comes out of the Senate would be a big deal because of that, though I imagine anything would be disappointing to a lot of gun safety advocates. And it's unclear what exactly is on the table. One of the policies that might have legs is a measure to incentivize states that have not already adopted red flag laws, which permit a family member or a law enforcement or in some places school administrators to petition to remove guns from somebody who is showing an acute threat to themselves or to others. One of the policies would incentivize states to adopt those reforms. 19 states have already done it, including plus the District of Columbia. And why that might have legs, especially amongst Republican caucus that tends to oppose any restrictions on firearm possession, is that the measure wouldn't actually mandate anything. It would leave it up to individual states and provide funding for the states themselves to decide whether or not to implement these policies. And so it would shift the debate back to the states. And some places like Oklahoma have already made clear that they would not adopt this measure. Oklahoma has recently passed an anti-red flag law. So that's one of that's the sort of thing that I'm watching for. It would be promising if there could be some bipartisan agreement on gun regulation, but most likely it wouldn't be strong regulation that you'd see coming out of the Senate.
And briefly, Eric, we're hearing a lot of different things from the police in this particular horrific shooting. One sentiment is that they felt like they were outgunned by the perpetrator with an AR-15 platform rifle. Do you see the police being a factor in limiting potentially the kinds of guns that are available in just our last few moments?
Yeah, so, I mean, police have consistently come out against various legislation that loosens gun restrictions for this very reason. And what you saw about the police feeling outgunned in this case, you also saw in Charlottesville, if you recall the protests. There, police felt that the armed protesters outgunned them. You see this in other places, in Dallas here, in fact. In Dallas, the shooting that happened in downtown Dallas, police felt outgunned. And this is, I think, something to think about when we consider the types of weapons that individuals have.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, studying Second Amendment rights. He's with us today to talk about lack of changes in federal gun laws despite a string of mass shootings over the years.